This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Earlier this month, Governor Ron DeSantis and the Florida Clemency Board granted posthumous pardons to the Groveland Four. Ernest Thomas, Charles Greenlee, Samuel Shepard and Walter Irvin, who were African-American, were accused of the 1949 rape of a white woman, Norma Padgett, under dubious circumstances. One of them was hunted down by a posse of about 1,000 men and shot more than 400 times. Three others were convicted. After the U.S. Supreme Court ordered a new trial in 1951, Lake County Sheriff Willis McCall shot two of them, claiming the handcuffed men were trying to escape. One died and the two surviving men were eventually paroled. At a dramatic clemency board hearing, Norma Padgett Upshaw spoke out opposing the pardons, and family members of the four men voiced their support for the pardons. Author Gilbert King, whose Pulitzer Prize-winning book Devil in the Grove examines the case of the Groveland Four, visited Orlando for a panel discussion hosted by the Central Florida Urban League and the Tiger Bay Club of Central Florida last week. King says he believes the four men will ultimately be exonerated too.
A lot happened in the last couple of weeks, the first few weeks of the new governor, Ron DeSantis's tenure, and chief among them for you, I guess, the pardoning of the Groveland Four. Just your reaction to that.
Well, I think, you know, we were leading up towards it. We were expecting it. We'd heard some advance notice that Governor DeSantis was going to look at this as soon as he got into office. I know that Commissioner Nikki Fried had said the same thing. She was going to make it a priority. And so we'd gotten word that this was going to happen. We were only under the impression that there was going to be a meeting about the agenda last Friday. And so all of a sudden, Norma Padgett showed up, and I think they said they called an audible. They said, well, we have to take her testimony, and then we'll have to have some of the family members who showed up testify. And it was amazing. They just went right to a vote at the end of the meeting. And none of us really expected it to happen that fast, but there you have it.
Had you talked to Norma Padgett before?
I tried to speak with her when I was writing the book probably 10 years ago. And I went and visited her where she was living, and we went back and forth a little bit, and her message to me was, let sleeping dogs lie. She did not want to revisit it, and I don't believe she's talked to anybody in 70 years until she showed up at that hearing last week.
What did you make of her testimony?
You know, one of the things I thought was kind of interesting is that 70 years ago, when she showed up at the Lake County courtroom in 1949 and stood up in the witness box and basically identified the Groveland boys as her attackers, those words had so much power. People in the courtroom said, that's the end of the trial right now. They don't even need to present any evidence. And that's how explosive those accusations were. You know, cut to 70 years later, last week in Tallahassee, and a lot had transpired over those years. All this information that was held from the defense, all of this evidence was now available to people who want to read about it and look into it. And so when Norma Padgett stuck to her story and really spoke out against the pardons, her words didn't carry as much power as they did 70 years ago. People were much more willing to look at and consider the evidence, and I think that's what pardons were based on, the evidence.
Did it cross your mind, though, that with Norma Padgett speaking out now, that could throw a wrench in the works of the pardon?
Yeah, it really did, and I think it's also one of those things where you look at, you know, the Me Too movement, and they're supposed to listen to women and the victims of sexual assault. And, you know, my contention all along was there was no sexual assault, that this actually did not happen. And so that was what I based my book on, the evidence that was presented. I really felt like this was really not about Norma Padgett in the end. To me, and I think the pardon board felt the same way, it was about the miscarriage of justice, the hiding of the witnesses, the suborning perjury, the manufacturing of evidence against the Groveland boys. Those are the things that needed to be corrected. Whether or not you believe what Norma Padgett said, that's just part of the story. The real story was the things that the prosecutor and the judge were doing against the Groveland boys in this trial that was just a miscarriage of justice.
So thinking about that testimony from Norma Padgett, I mean, either way, it was a powerful thing to hear her speak after so long.
It really was. I mean, and that's the thing. Like, we weren't really sure what it would mean. And so when we found out that she was going to actually speak, we wanted some of the family members to speak and to tell their story and to tell their pain and to, you know, to recognize that they too were victims. I mean, the sheriff shot three of them, and two of them died. So it was important that, you know, there was a balanced testimony. But I really think the whole thing really came down to the fact that the we had a coalition for clemency, and it was a very powerful group of people who were really committed, working pro bono. Edelman Public Relations, Chris Hand was a lobbyist in Tallahassee, who was tremendously helpful in just helping get this word out and speaking to politicians. And so our thoughts all along were that they were going to base it on the evidence and just not the testimony.
Well, talk up a little bit, if you could, Gilbert King, about the testimony we heard from the family members of the Groveland Four. What do we hear, and what kind of impact do you think it had on the clemency board ultimately?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just reminded everybody in the audience and also on the board that there were really true victims that suffered extreme violence at the hand of law enforcement in the state of Florida. And so when they testified, some of the family members testified that, you know, this was a loss, that they lost their father, they lost their uncle, and it was sort of, their rights were trampled on. They were never the same, and the families would never discuss this, and they lived in shame because the official story that lingered in Lake County for the families that stayed behind was that their families were rapists, and that lingered for decades and decades, and it was just this mark of shame that they were just happy to have it relieved after the decision.
Is it unusual for you to get so involved in a book or the story after your book is published? I'm just kind of wondering, you know, because Devil in the Grove made a huge impression, and then, of course, the sort of follow-up in some ways, Under a Ruthless Sun, which also tells the story of the sheriff in this case.
Right.
Is it kind of strange to have your book make a big impression and then sort of be caught up in the machinery of what comes next?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing you can really expect when you start out writing something like this. You know, all I remember is like early on saying, oh my, this is a miscarriage of justice, and just being aware that these men were wrongly accused and wrongly convicted, and then they suffered so much violence. And I remember my initial thought was, I just need to get this story out there. And I think if people read it, they'll find a history about Florida that they weren't aware of. To actually see it lead to the exonerations, that's just something I never really expected. I have no experience with that. But, you know, I do think I was committed to sort of, I had the time to find out the truth. And I think that was the thing. I didn't do a really fast job on this. These books take me like 5 years. I'm very careful about the evidence that I present. And so I was very confident that I was on the side of right in terms of my research. And so it's just so nice to be able to see people be able to take, you know, pick the baton up and run with it and just bring it towards closure and give these families some relief.
Given that, you know, the pardon happened in the space of a single hearing, do you still have some questions about why the previous administration did not take that step?
No, you know, the only thing I could think of is just that, it was leadership. I just think that the new cabinet came in and just said, well, this is the right thing to do, and they were just determined to make it happen. And I think maybe they just didn't weigh the political costs that maybe the Scott administration did when they were looking at it, and when Pam Bondi and some of them just sort of refused to act on it. I think we've talked about it. We said it's just a matter of leadership. Who was willing to stand up and say what was right? I don't think they saw a political cost by doing this. This was a bipartisan effort in the legislature. You had Lake County officials coming forward saying these men should be pardoned. They officially apologized on the behalf of Lake County. So I thought once that kind of testimony made it to Governor DeSantis, who had some experience representing Lake County, I thought that was really powerful for him, and he admitted it in the hearing.
It's one thing for officials in Lake County to say, look, there was a miscarriage of justice, we need to right that wrong. But what impression do you have of the impact of this pardon on the way the Groveland Four may be regarded or their legacy in Lake County? Are there still some holdouts who say, no, what was done back then was the right move?
Yeah, I would think that there are certain family members of Norma Padgett's family who are not very happy about this. Norma made that clear when she testified that she was against the pardons, and she swore that she told the truth way back then. I just think the problem is there's just been so much evidence that's come forward. I mean, FBI documents that were not available at the time, a lot of evidence that got quashed by the judge and by the U.S. attorney that would have exonerated these guys, and it was hidden. And I think the board felt the same way. The evidence was just overwhelming that they were wrongly accused. And so I think there are still people that are going to cling to it, but I don't think there's many. If you look into it, you look into the evidence, it's pretty obvious what happened.
What's next for you as far as the story? Is there another chapter or a postscript to write to Devil in the Grove?
You know, the only thing that's left is these were pardons that were given officially last week in Tallahassee. The next step is to sort of do a report. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement is working with the Attorney General's office, and they've asked me to sort of give them a lot of the documents that I came up with, which of course I'm doing. And it's
kind of strange for an author to be sort of asked to turn stuff over to law enforcement, right? I mean, is there some irony in you having to turn over some of the stuff you uncovered that maybe the law enforcement agencies back then should have done?
Yeah, that's a really great point, because I did spend a lot of time trying to get them from the law enforcement agencies to begin with. But I think they just feel it would be faster if they knew all, and if I could point them in the direction of evidence that would be helpful to the report. So I don't really mind that at all. I'm happy to do that, because I think the next step is going to be an exoneration, and that has to come through the Attorney General's recommendation. We're pretty confident that that's going to be the next step. I don't think you would go this far and then stop short of exoneration.
Of course, thinking about the previous administration, Pam Bondi, as you say, member of the Clemency Board as well, that didn't take up the case when they could have. What do you know about the new Attorney General, Ashley Moody, and maybe your sense of how quick this process may be, or what the pitfalls and loopholes may be in trying to get that exoneration?
Yeah, my understanding is that all of the pardon board members came forward, the clemency board, and said that they were in favor of this and that they had already looked at the evidence and they were pretty clear about it. So I have a really good feeling about it. I definitely think Ashley Moody takes this very seriously, and she understands how important it is to correct the past, even though you're not bringing anybody back to life, the importance of just recognizing that this was a miscarriage of justice and that it helps us go forward if we can acknowledge these. So I do believe that she takes it very seriously. I think she's going to do a very solid investigation into the exoneration, and I think it's going to be the next step.
Gilbert King, when we spoke last year about your other book, Under a Ruthless Sun, you said originally you had no intention of coming back to Lake County again and doing another investigation, writing another book about it, and then somebody came forward and said, look, I've got the story that really needs to be told. Has anything similar happened now? I mean, do you feel like you're drawn back to this part of the country, and are there more stories that really need to be aired out and told here?
There are a lot of stories, and I do a lot of speaking at, like, judges' conferences and bar associations. And so afterwards, when I'm signing books and talking to the lawyers and judges, I always get stories told to me, and they're fascinating. And, you know, some of them are like, you need to look into this. I can tell you everything you need to know. And sure enough, this happened to me over the summer. I found another case in Polk County. And it's a strange miscarriage of justice where there's an innocent man sitting in jail right now, and the evidence absolutely backs up the fact that he's innocent. So I don't know if it's going to be a book. I do know it's going to be a long-form article, at least. I'm just still really doing the research on it, but everything I'm finding out points to a really fascinating story of an innocent man who's been convicted.
Do you need to take a break from delving into these crime stories?
Yeah, I really should, like, sit down and write, like, a wizard book, you know, fiction, sit up in a cabin somewhere and just give my brain a rest. But the problem is, this is really what I really enjoy doing. I really love the research and trying to find out these puzzles and trying to solve these, you know, long ago mysteries and bring people back into the story who haven't talked to anybody in a long time. So I know this is what I like doing, so I really don't need a break from it. The overwhelming feeling I have is one of relief to see that the families just derive so much, I wouldn't say pleasure is the right word, but the amount of, like, just contentness and happiness from being able to see the clemency board rule this way, that has been really nourishing to me, because I've gotten to spend a lot of time with the families. I know how much it meant to them, and just to play any little role to sort of support their efforts has meant the world to me.
Gilbert King is the author of Devil in the Grove and Under a Ruthless Sun. Thank you so much for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Matthew.
Up next on Intersection, the host of the podcast Murder on the Space Coast says his deep dive into crime reporting has changed the way he looks at the criminal justice system.
Growing up, I was always very pro-law enforcement, and I still am, and pro-prosecution. But now it really makes me question everything, because I've seen a lot of wrongdoings. You know, I've always wondered, why would anybody plea bargain when they're innocent? Now I do understand why, because the deck can get stacked against you so high, and if people start lying, you have no chance.
A conversation with Florida Today news columnist John A. Torres when we return. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida Today news columnist John A. Torres' podcast Murder on the Space Coast is now in its fourth season. Previous seasons have dealt with cold cases and miscarriages of justice. In season 4, Tordes takes a closer look at a murder committed at the height of Florida's pill mill crisis and a case that he says may have led to a wrongful conviction. John A. Tordes, welcome back to Intersection.
Hey, Matthew, I really appreciate you having me on as always. Thanks.
So when we spoke to you last, we were talking about season 3, which was the story of a missing firefighter, Brandy Hall. Before we start on season 4, I want to ask about what happened with that. One of the characters you interviewed for that podcast was a retired police detective. He was very interested in sort of pursuing the case and trying to get some resolution. What came out of that podcast?
Well, actually, Matthew, it's ongoing and it's very exciting. Actually, a retired cop from the Carolinas who is from Palm Bay happened to be driving back home to Palm Bay and he heard the podcast. Now he's a private investigator. And he has reopened a fresh, brand new investigation, and I am working very closely with him, and he has new leads. He has found things out that have never been revealed to us or the Palm Bay police, and I can't really talk a lot about the exact details right now, but he thinks that there's more of a drug angle to Brandy's disappearance than we were led to believe. So we'll see what happens.
Were the Palm Bay police following along as well? Were they kind of interested to see what came out of the podcast, if it threw up any new leads?
Well, yes. And in fact, we sent them a few leads and they have. And so the actual detective in charge has been working on it, but it moves pretty slowly, you know, especially late last year, Matthew. I think Palm Bay had 3 murders in 4 months or something like that. So they've been tied up with active cases and they haven't been able to go back. You know, this case happened in 2006. And so it's kind of on the back burner for them. However, the private eye, you know, he's working pro bono for the family of Brandy Hall. And, you know, I really think he's made some great inroads. So I'm excited to see what happens and to update our listeners when the time comes.
What kind of response did you get from your listeners to that season as well? Were they interested in following along with the case?
Oh, my gosh, yes. And you know what's interesting, Matthew, is that we got a lot of new listeners for season 3, you know, because Brandy Hall here in Brevard County is a very well-known name. And a lot of these people went back and listened to seasons 1 and 2, which were unrelated cases. And so the like podcast has really grown organically from that. And we're closing in on 1 million listens as I speak to you right now.
So let's talk a little bit about season 4. This is a slightly different tack you're taking for this season. Tell me about it.
It just has everything that you can imagine in a case. I mean, if this was a Quentin Tarantino movie, you wouldn't even blink because it'd be like, okay, well, I expect all these crazy things from him, right? But it's basically about the murder in 2002 of a 78-year-old man in Melbourne, you know, Florida, who was an OxyContin dealer. And he's basically found clutching someone's hair, someone else's blood is in his bathroom sink, and yet somebody else is now serving life in prison for the murder. And it's very bizarre, it's very strange. We have evidence of homicide agents who lied on the witness stand. We've got witnesses who lied. We have a lawyer with mental illness who did not disclose her condition to our subject in this case, and one appeal after another, and it's just an eye-opening case.
So you're saying that Jeff Abramowski, you're saying he was served a raw deal in this case, and you're hoping that there'll be another look at his case?
Well, yeah. You know, Matthew, we have the homicide agent for the Brevard County Sheriff's Office. We have his interrogation video, and he says one thing. And then on the witness stand, he denies ever saying that. And we went back and listened to it over and over again. And we're like, wow, he lied on the witness stand. So, I mean, what chance have you got? You know, then all the witnesses in the case, every single one of them, we have all of their original interviews with the police. And at trial, the stories changed completely. And we have audio from both, and we just can't believe it. We're, you know, everybody lied in this case. And so how do you stand? I mean, how do you call that a fair trial? You know, I have a lot of friends who are attorneys who say that a jury's verdict is sacred, but it's only sacred if the cops do the right thing, the lawyers do the right thing, the prosecutors, the judges, and the witnesses tell the truth. And then it's a sacred, you know, verdict. Otherwise, it's tainted. It was known briefly around here as the claw hammer killing. You know, Jeff Abramowski was a family man, a father. He was ex-Coast Guard. And he had a car accident in the late 1990s at the corner of Palm Bay Road and Babcock Street, which, if anybody knows that part of town here in Brevard County, is a very busy intersection. And he got into a terrible accident there driving his kids to school one morning, and he got hooked on OxyContin. And he basically lost his wife, his family, his home, his job. And he became friends with this older man who was his dealer, and he would take him around, you know, pharmacy shopping, you know, when all the pill mills were in operation here in Central Florida, which, you know, thankfully, I think a lot of them have been shut down. And so he would go, and because he had x-rays and he had MRIs from his real injury, he was able to get OxyContin from several doctors, and he would give them to this older man in exchange for money, et cetera. And one weekend, the old man ends up dead. Now, Jeff was a drug addict, a stone-cold drug addict. The old man was found with 90 OxyContins in his pocket and $200. And so you would think that a drug addict would, you know, would take that. And so I don't want to give too much away, but there's a lot of evidence that point at other suspects in this case that have just been glossed over. And, you know, like I said, if Jeff is guilty, that's, you know, fine, but he deserves a fair trial. And for everybody to lie in this case, and either either they all lied when they initially spoke to the police, or they lied on the witness stand, but they lied.
How many of the people who are involved in the original case are still on the police force or still involved in law enforcement? Or are you talking about people who are sort of long retired from this?
Well, the main person in the case was homicide agent Gary Harrell with the Brevard County Sheriff's Office. He was the lead detective in the case. He has retired. I have been in contact with him. I'm trying to get an interview still. We had something set up and he canceled last minute. A few of the other officers are still active here in the sheriff's office. And prosecutor Rob Parker, John Robert Parker, he's retired, but he was able to grant me a very long interview, and he was open about everything in the case, you know, from his perspective. And it's just a great case for us to look at as a podcast, Matthew, because everything was tape recorded. I mean, we have recordings of every police interview, every interrogation, everything that was done in this case, the trial, just all of it. And so with our new interviews and the old stuff, I think we are really putting together quite an investigative piece.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty, speaking with John A. Torres, news columnist with Florida Today, about the latest installment of his podcast, Murder on the Space Coast. John, thinking about the era that this crime happened, you talk about the height of the pill mill crisis. Is it interesting to sort of go back and listen to some of those tapes and think about what you were writing about back then and kind of reflect on how things have changed a bit as far as where Florida is now and dealing with that crisis?
It's unreal, Matthew. I mean, what a change. And for the good, you know, I mean, obviously, although, you know, as you know, I had to reschedule an earlier interview with you because I threw my back out last week. When I would do that in the past, I would just get a bunch of like pills just like tossed at me. You know, doctors can only give you 12 pain pills at a time, which, you know, is perfect because that's all you need. But it's funny because I was living in Indy Atlantic, Florida, on the beach. And right around the corner from where I lived was a pill mill doctor, but I didn't know. And every morning I'd see a line of, it looked like homeless people lined up outside his place. And I thought it was an employment agency or something, some sort of workforce office. And it turned out to be a pill mill doctor. But yeah, I mean, I haven't seen one of those out in a long time now around here, thank goodness.
So was Brevard County particularly hard hit by the opioid crisis?
Oh yeah, I think it was. And you know, unfortunately, when you crack down on that now, we have a rise in incidents of heroin overdoses and you know, heroin sales here in some parts of the county, in like the Cape Canaveral area, I believe, and also Cocoa. There's a lot of you know, heroin, I'm told, on the rise and overdoses. So yeah, I mean, it's a problem still.
Was there a lot of interest in this case at the time? And I'm kind of wondering if it's a case that's still pretty fresh in people's memories, or if this podcast is going to make people think, huh, I'd kind of forgotten about that.
Oh, yeah. No, it hardly received any media at all. I think I wrote a story or two about it. You know, someone else wrote about the verdict. But nobody went into it, Matthew. I mean, how the victim was clutching hair from somebody and the hair belonged to a woman. And the woman's son, her adult son, his blood is in the bathroom sink. And they had had a major, you know, fight with the old man just a few days earlier. And so, you know, none of that was ever really reported. And then the lawyer's mental illness, and then just going back and just listening to the tapes and to what the people actually said, to what they ended up saying on the stand, it's just, it's really eye-opening. And I think it'll be a brand new case for almost everybody. I'll be shocked if anybody really knows about this case when the podcast airs.
As you've been producing these podcasts, taking a deep dive look at different cases season per season, have people been coming forward to you and pitching you ideas? Like if you had some people come and say, look, I really think you should take a look at this cold case or this unsolved murder or this miscarriage of justice?
All the time, Matthew, which I encourage and I love. I actually have a file of, you know, future seasons that we hope to look at and end up producing. You know, I mean, a lot of it really hinges on how many people are still available to interview and try to get audio, because, you know, if it's just me talking for the full half hour episode, it's kind of boring. But it's interesting to hear, you know, the voices from the time and the trials and the police and all the interrogations. But yeah, I have a list of stuff that we are hoping to reach.
I'm kind of curious to know too, if it's changed your approach to column writing. I mean, focusing so much on crime and these in some cases unsolved mysteries for the podcast series, has it made you sort of rethink the other part of your job, which is newspaper columnist?
Yeah, I mean, it really has. Although, to be honest with you, Matthew, for the last year or so, I pretty much have only been working on the podcast. You know, maybe I've written about 10 columns over the last year. But growing up, I was always very pro-law enforcement, and I still am, and pro-prosecution. But now it really makes me question everything, because I've seen a lot of wrongdoings. You know, I've always wondered, why would anybody plea bargain when they're innocent? Now I do understand why, because the deck can get stacked against you so high, and if people start lying, you have no chance. And so, a lot of the times, the only way out is unfortunately a plea bargain and to admit to something you didn't do, which is mind blowing, you know, to me. I still can't wrap my mind around that completely.
What about the reaction from some people too? I'm wondering if there might be some people who are like, we really shouldn't be poking into this case. Just let it lie.
Oh yeah. I also get that. I have gotten that from police officers and the prosecutor's office here. Why not just leave well enough alone? And I think part of the mindset back then, and I hope it's changed, I don't know, is that the cops, the prosecutors, everybody just kind of went for the easy target. You know, Jeff Abramowski wasn't doing any good for society. He was a drug addict. He was a drain on the system. You know, he was living on couches of his friends' homes. He's just an easy target. And in season two of Murder on the Space Coast, we look at the wrongful incarcerations of men who were cleared by DNA, Wilton Dedge, William Dillon, Juan Ramos, etc. Easy targets, you know, easy targets for the cops to solve and close cases. And I really hope that's changed.
And from what you've said, it sounds like Jeff Abramowski, it sounded like a real fall from grace for him. As you say, he'd been a family man, he got involved in this terrible accident, and then everything went wrong for the guy.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. He had a beautiful wife, his, you know, kids, his, you know, like daughter Jamie, who's now 30 years old, has her own family. He's missed her high school graduation, her wedding, her children, et cetera. He is very close to his children. I think his son is 25 or 26 now. Yeah, I mean, he lost everything, and, you know, he admitted it. And he actually tried getting help. He actually was on methadone for a while to try to kick the OxyContin. But, it was just, way too easy to get. And unless you really have a strong support system to help you out of that cycle, I'm not really sure what the answer is.
John A. Torres, thanks so much for joining us. The new season of the podcast series Murder on the Space Coast is out now.
Awesome, Matthew. I really appreciate you having us on. And I just want to tell people to go to murderonthespacecoast.com.
Still to come on Intersection, a conversation with the director of the Florida Project about why he prefers to watch movies on the big screen, what the actors from his hit feature set on the outskirts of Disney are up to now, and the power of film to spark change.
I only can make one film every, 3 years? That's how long it takes to make one of these. And even though I am a cinephile and I love all genres, and sometimes I love popcorn movies and fluff, I feel a responsibility to use my time responsibly and tackle social issues. I think that films can truly bring about change, or at least ignite change and spark change.
Sean Baker joins us for a conversation when we return. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Film director Sean Baker believes films have the power to spark change. Baker's movies explore the lives of underrepresented communities like trans sex workers in his 2015 feature Tangerine, or the hidden homeless in the 2017 film The Florida Project. Set in a motel in Kissimmee, The Florida Project tells the story of a 6-year-old and her mother struggling to keep a roof over their heads in the shadow of Disney World. The Florida Project won over audiences both for its unflinching look at the reality of homelessness and for the acting of Bria Venaicha, who plays a single mother, and Brooklyn Prince, who plays her 6-year-old daughter. Since then, Prince, who's now 8 years old, has gone on to direct her own short film. Baker is speaking at Rollins College tomorrow as part of the Winter Park Institute speaker series. I caught up with him by Skype from Vancouver, where he's based at the moment. He began by talking about the impact of The Florida Project.
Actually, to tell you the truth, it's still being released around the world, so even though the award season in the U.S. is focused on very different films this year, meaning, you know, a whole new wave of films, the Florida Project is still getting on some top tens from foreign critics, and it's still seeing releases overseas. So, yes, it's continuing to go, and it's been a nice rollout. It's been a nice long rollout.
We talked to your co-screenwriter, Chris Bagosh, a couple years back about the genesis of the movie. I wonder if you could kind of share a little bit of your perspective on what it was that made you really want to get this film made.
Well, yes, Chris Bagosh, my co-screenwriter on this film, brought this idea to my attention. I honestly had not even heard of the term hidden homeless before looking into the materials that Chris sent me. Of course, we, you know, as living in New York for a while, living in LA for a while, you know, I think like all of us, I've thought of homelessness as people you see on the street, you know, and that doesn't entirely define homelessness in the United States and in the world. There's a population of the hidden homeless, which are people who are technically homeless, but still keeping a roof over their heads, struggling to keep a roof over their heads at any cost. And those are people who are living in budget motels. Those are people who are living in RVs, people who are living in with friends and family. So this was something that I was very much taken aback by and also intrigued. I wanted to know more. You know, I personally believe we have and I think that most people would agree with me, we have an affordable housing crisis in the United States and in the world. And to know that there were families who were technically homeless living within miles of a place that we consider almost a paradise for families and children, the irony was just so in our face that we couldn't ignore it. And so that's how we went down that road of exploring that topic and having it taking place in Central Florida, with its, you know, close proximity to the amusement parks, but hopefully also getting across the point to the audience is that this is something that could happen anywhere in the United States, and it could be happening right under your nose in your own community. And that's the ultimate goal of the movie, to shed light on this and to, you know, to hope to inspire change.
Has it inspired some of that places you've shown it? Has it kind of gotten people to really take another look at this problem of hidden homelessness, or even just homelessness in general?
I think so, and I hope so. You know, shedding light on it is just one part of it's just one minor step towards, you know, eradicating homelessness. When I speak to, we work with nonprofits in the area, and there's one in particular in Kissimmee by the name of the Community Hope Center. And they were just so incredible opening their arms to us and helping us understand the situation as best as we could. And they always said the first step in eradicating homelessness is to remove the stigma associated with homelessness. And that is, I think, what this film is helping to do. I mean, I hope. That's my hope. And yes, I've seen first off people coming my way asking how they can help. I've heard from the nonprofits telling me that they've received wonderful, you know, charitable donations. But again, it's a long road, and it's about changing the mindset of people, I think, in general. Now, but there is one major change, you know, one major wonderful piece of news that came from the making of this film. And that's the opportunity that was given to, you know, Christopher Rivera, who plays one of the three children in the film. His life has very much been changed by this film. And I wish I could take credit, but I can't. This was actually something that my distributor, A24, and Rollins College, based in Orlando, Florida, they work together, and they have offered Christopher Rivera a full scholarship when he reaches the age of, you know, going to college. So It's a wonderful thing. I know that for me is the major, that is the major success. That is the main success of this film. The fact that it has changed Christopher's life and that he has a whole new, you know, path that he can take. You know, everybody says, oh, the success of your film is Willem Dafoe being nominated for an Academy Award. I mean, yes, that's nice. That's nice. But for me, this film is about, you know, truly changing lives. And what it has done for Christopher is what I'm most proud of.
Do you keep in touch with all of the actors, especially some of the actors who this was one of their first roles in a film or as a professional actor? Do you keep tabs on what they're up to?
Always. You know, with every one of my films, I've made six features now. And, you know, Florida being obviously the one that probably most people know about. But each one of my films, I'm usually focusing on a community that is underrepresented. And the way I go about doing that is casting from that community as well. And a lot of these people are first timers, you know, so and sometimes they go on to having acting careers and sometimes they don't. But no matter what, we're friends. We've forged a friendship, and it's something that is long lasting. So, yes, in terms of the Florida project, you know, I'm in touch with all of them. And when I come down to Rollins to speak, I'll be seeing both Christopher's family and Christopher, and I'll also be seeing Valeria's family and Valeria. Valeria played Jancy in the movie, mm-hmm. who was the best friend to Mooney, played by Brooklyn Prince. And of course, I'm very much in touch with her. She's actually, I'm speaking to you from Vancouver right now in Canada, and she's up here as well, and she's starring in her own show. It's a big show that Apple TV is producing and backing, and she's the lead. And it's incredible the path that she's taken. And, you know, we see each other all the time. I executive produced a short film that she directed. And yeah, you heard me right, directed. She's only 8 years old, and she directed a short film for Facebook and Instagram. So, you know, I was there to EP that film, executive produce, and that involves mentoring her and helping her dreams come true, which is that, you know, Brooklyn Prince is just such an amazing individual. I consider her a real prodigy, somebody along the lines of like a Jodie Foster. You know, I see that she could have that career trajectory, and I'm very, very proud of her.
Yeah, that's incredible at the age of eight to be directing a film. Yeah. You mentioned that it was released on Instagram and Facebook as well?
Yes, it's actually through a program called Curated by FB, Facebook. And it's Facebook and Instagram working together. They're going to be releasing three short films shot in a vertical style, meaning the way that you shoot when your phone is not, you know, horizontal, it's vertical. So this is a vertically shot short film by three celebrities, and Brooklyn Prince being one of them.
Can you tell us what it's about?
Well, Brooklyn also wrote it. So it's very much what you would almost imagine coming from an 8-year-old. It's about two best friends, two little girls, and one of them unfortunately falls sick. And it's about how the other girl is dealing with her friend's sickness and how she tries to battle and confront her fears. Mm. And it's really beautiful. I mean, it's called Colors because it's full of colors and full of rainbows. And Brooklyn presented us with this idea, and she even had, you know, it was actually based on I think something she had gone through. And so she actually presented us with this wonderful idea and gave us a beginning, middle, and end. And we just sat down and taught her about screenplay format and knocked out a script with her, and then moved right into production. She's it's really incredible to see it happen.
Is it easy to kind of get those ideas across? Because I mean, I get the sense that kids are just, you know, they're using smartphones, they're making movies, whether or not they're, you know, for widespread production and release, they're pretty familiar with this technology, right? So does that make it easier to kind of get across some of those ideas about screenplay and pacing and everything else that goes into making a movie?
I think so. And I'm only basically comparing this experience to my own, because I look back when I started making short films around the same age. But with me, it was picking up my parents' Super 8 camera and having to just make things up as I went along. You know, I didn't have any guidance. I didn't really have that. There's so much content out there being delivered that I think that at Brooklyn is able to, you know, she already comes to her first rodeo with a ton of experience, you know, and because she's being inundated with content all the time, that generation is absorbing content in a much different way than we did, or that I did. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in my late 40s, and when I grew up, we started off with what, three networks and a few cable stations. This is pre-internet. So it's a whole different, I think that the young Brooklyn's generation has a whole different way of even perceiving, you know, watching content, and what they pick up must be on a whole different level. I can't even really wrap my head around it.
Do you know kind of how people are watching your movie, any of your movies, really? But the Florida Project specifically, like, was it released in other forms other than for cinema release?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. I mean, when it comes down to it, since the onset of home entertainment, and I'm talking way back with VHS tapes and Betamax tapes, the majority of your audience will be people watching your film at home. Okay, that's just something, that's just a reality that you have to accept, and that's fine. That's where most eyes will be seeing your product. But as a filmmaker and a cinephile, somebody who loves cinema, I make films to be for the ideal situation, for the ideal viewing experience, which I consider a theater going experience. You know, you go to the theater in a dark room with a crowd, with optimal sound and picture quality. And I feel that, you know, unless you have your own personal theater and in your basement, there's no way that anybody's home system is, even with a 4K television, is coming close to what you experience inside a movie theater. So I make my films for the movie theater, but knowing that probably 90% of the audiences will be seeing things at home. And yes, you can watch it on an iPhone. You can watch it on, you know, my films have basically, all my films have been released. And so they're all on the different streaming platforms, and they're also on Blu-ray and DVD. That's always there. But I always hope that people can see it at the their local art house cinema, or sometimes even a multiplex, depending on where you are.
Mm-hmm. How do you consume media and films? Like, do you by and large watch them in theaters, or do you find yourself watching a lot of stuff on your phone?
I actually never watch anything on my phone, you know, unless it's something that's a, you know, an Instagram story or perhaps a news story. I don't really watch any, I don't think I watch any fiction narrative content or even documentaries, not really on my phone, just because I don't find it to be the best way of absorbing the information and to see what the filmmaker has intended on the visual side of things. So, you know, I go to the movies a lot, probably way more than most people. I'm seeing, you know, a few films a week in the theater, which I know is very, you know, but I'm a filmmaker. This is my industry. This is my livelihood. So this is something that I do because I want to continue learning. I want to see what other people have done. I want to support the industry. So I go to the movies a lot. And then I also still purchase physical media, which I know not many people do anymore, but I still find it extremely valuable. There are, you know, I buy Blu-rays, and I find the quality of Blu-rays to be, you know, sometimes more reliable, let's say that, than your streaming. And then also streaming services come and go. Sometimes I feel that they can be, they can't be that reliable. So I'm still a supporter of physical media, and I'm still a supporter of seeing films in the theater. But then, of course, I always fall back on my streaming services too, and I'm a big supporter of, you know, Netflix, Fandor, Canopy, the many wonderful streaming sites out there that carry great content.
Do you feel, Sean Baker, because it sounds like the Florida Project especially is really, it's beyond a movie, right? I mean, sounds like it's become a bit of a cause that you're following. Do you find people coming to you and saying, look, make a movie about the homeless in this community or focus on this as well?
Oh, 100%. But it's also what Hollywood does. When you make a movie, they see you as that sort of director or that writer. And they try to paint you into a corner and say, this is what he or she does. So yeah, when I make a film about trans sex workers, like I did with Tangerine, I get a million scripts and a million producers coming my way saying, hey, here's a new film. It's about two trans women. I'm like, well, that's funny because I just did that. Why would I do it again right now? You know, and now, of course, these topics can always be explored more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it really comes down to what I think I feel I want to address in the moment. Like right now, I'm working on something about the opioid crisis in the United States. Actually, I'm not focusing on the opioid crisis in the United States. I am criticizing the war on drugs in the United States by showing how the approach to, you know, drug addiction and drug use in general has been tackled in the United States and how I don't agree with that. So that's my next film. And, you know, if you look back on my filmography, I try to be socially conscious with my films. I feel that I only can make one film every, 3 years? That's how long it takes to make one of these. And even though I am a cinephile and I love all genres and sometimes I love popcorn movies and fluff, I feel a responsibility to use my time responsibly and tackle social issues. I think that films can, you know, can truly bring about change, or at least, you know, ignite change and spark change. And that's what I want to do with my films. And that's part of what I'll be talking about at Rollins. I'll be talking about how I feel, not that my films have perhaps done it yet, but what I aspire my films to do, you know, and I'm going to be speaking about other filmmakers whose films have truly brought about significant change.
And I imagine there'll be aspiring filmmakers who'd be keen to chat to you too when you come to speak at Rollins.
Yes, I'm not sure how many. I hate giving words of advice when it comes to filmmaking because everybody's path is different. But, you know, we will be having a Q&A session after my talk, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions people have. And then, of course, I'll be, you know, talking about in general how I see where I see the industry and what it takes to actually break into the industry these days.
Sean Baker's films include The Florida Project, about hidden homelessness on the outskirts of Central Florida's theme parks. Baker will give a talk at Rollins College tomorrow as part of the Winter Park Institute Speaker Series. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or on the NPR One app, and you can find previous episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter @Matthew_Petty, and thanks for listening.